intro music. We still don't know how to work it.
We don't know how to work it. Sorry if it sounded terrible, because it's a Michael Morelli made us intro music, and it gives us like 80s vibes, which is perfect because we are.
We actually had quite a few people offer to make us music, and who knows, he'll be. We may just rotate.
We might just make this rotation, like.
But this one really
today.
This one hit us in the heart.
Yeah.
And thank you to Michael. Shout out to the man that I called Canada for most of beer camp because I didn't know what his name was. And then I called another man who I thought was him, Canada, and he turned out to be from Mexico. And
neighbors.
He thought, right, according to Bad Bunny. So
we're all Americans. It's fine.
And then it was so funny because I think the guy, because we were in this like supposed to be this heated like game show thing. And I think the guy who I called Canada, I kept saying Canada to this guy who's from Mexico. And I think afterwards he was just like, I thought you were trying to, you were maybe being racist, but like you just kept calling me Canada. He couldn't work out like how that was being that way. And I was like my accent does lend itself to racism, but no, like I just really thought you were another human being.
It was really funny.
He came up to me, he goes, I'm not from Canada. You really talked a lot about it. This is again on the Adaman night.
It was also like beer camp. We
were drinking.
Be held responsible for really anything.
No, there's a lot of dudes, and like I really thought
it was the same.
They do. There's a lot of beards happening. Lots of beards. So anyway, Michael, aka now I know who you are.
Thank you for our first intro music. At some point, maybe we'll figure out how to properly play it.
Maybe,
but maybe not.
For me. I don't have my glasses. I don't have my drink, and I just got out of the shower.
We're so. Doing super well.
I'm shooting 10 for 10 today. I have clothes on.
What I'm drinking, which is going to...
Yes?
It's your...
Truly Unruly!
The last... two of the Truly Unruly lemonades that Leah had when she was here.
And we decided to drink something that we wanted to get rid of.
Yeah.
We are being, it's the point in the semester where we're being practical.
Yeah. We were like, let's drink something we want not to have anymore.
And which I am personally offended that I left you all but like one of those and that you are haven't drank them all yet. Setting.
They're interesting. This one is pineapple flavored. So
Truly Unruly will always make me think of Taylor Thomas. I don't know. We had something where she just really loved that name. He just really loved that name.
Yeah.
And he like shouted or something, like Truly Unruly! And forever. I will now associate with him because I just am like, I want to shout it.
Every time.
It's like whenever our friends from Scotland put up a thing about the king, a declaration from the king about Epstein and Prince Andrew. And I was said every time that I see a declaration from the king, I think a message from the king.
I do the same.
Hamilton, which made, you know, I mean, they're not royalist anyway, so it's fine.
I have like 19 different things that I say during class that immediately trigger a song in my head. And then during, like, I'm still trying to teach, but I'm also singing a song in my head. Like, but there's something. So today it was Heart-Shaped Box by Nirvana.
You know why it was that?
Why? Oh, it's Stuart posted a picture of a heart-shaped pizza.
Yes, you also had that in your head. And the reason Stuart does a post, I got onto him a little while ago because he never posts on social media at all.
I know. And I've been enjoying his weekly update.
His weekly post. So he'll take like one picture a day and he'll post it. And his captions are quite funny. We had a Galentine's night with me and two of my besties here in Charlotte. And then we got heart-shaped pizzas.
I have so many
Which
questions.
Were actually very good, I will say.
Where did you get it from?
I don't know if I want to give them.
Oh, okay. That's
hard,
fine.
It's not hard to figure out based on
Secondly, my more pressing question is, how did you cut it? Because the picture, it looks like it's uncut.
Well,
so you had to cut it.
One of my friends and I...
What are the shapes of the pizza slices? How did you do that?
One of my friends and I have a very similar personality, and when things are hard, we just don't do them. And then the other one is quite practical.
That's nice to have around.
It is. So we just didn't eat that one because we got two other regular pizzas. So the practical one was late, got there, and was like, are y'all not going to eat this? Or and we just stared at her like, it would be like if a Martian presented Martian food to you and was like, me and my power just like, nah, that feels difficult.
It's too hard.
I will say the common denominator between my friend and I who do that is that we were and are both married, and the other one is single and lives by herself. And I feel like there's a lot more like fortitude is built when one lives by themselves. I had that at one stage, but I don't anymore.
One time I was talking to my friend, we were FaceTiming. And she said, oh, sorry, my smoke detector, the battery is dead, so it's beeping. And I was like, well, why don't you change it? And she was like, I know she said it kept her up all night. She didn't sleep because it's beeping. And I was like, change the battery. And she was like, well, I don't know where the batteries are.
Nope.
Because her husband always changes. And I said, it cannot be that hard to find them, because he was going to be gone for the whole weekend. So she had like two more nights ahead of her. And I was like, are you just going to not change that?
Noise canceling
multiple times of not sleeping. And she didn't. She waited until he got home and he changed. And I was like,
part of the issue is if you were to ask me right now, like I'll give you $1 million. You can tell me where the batteries are. First of all, I'm going to lose. Second of all, because I don't have said fortitude, I'll give up looking very quickly. And again, I'm not one of those that are like, I see all these posts that are like, oh my God, I don't have to worry about taking my purse or like driving to somewhere as soon as my husband, she's got my ID. Like, I am not that person. In fact, I get a little angry about that.
But like,
fight this hard for civil rights to go. I will say, there are parts, because I have an anxious brain, that I tell Stuart that I'm like, this is yours now. Like, I'm not going to think about that anymore. And so the smoke detector would definitely fall into that. You'll be happy to know I carry my own ID. I'm the only one that can drive in the house. And I have a wallet.
I can't quite wrap my head around living for multiple days with it beeping.
Oh, see, that would make me crazy. I would have ripped it off the wall, though. I would have taken
confined.
Just take out. I think you can just take out the battery.
I mean, that or you can probably find the batteries. I mean, if you live in this house, there's not like
my said single friend who knows how to like live life. She took care of my cats. Whenever I was at, I may have been with you, probably, honestly.
Yeah.
And she just said, your smoke detector's going off, like the battery's about to go dead. And I said, oh, don't worry about it. We have animals. I was like, just don't worry about it. It's fine. She went all the way to a store.
Yeah.
And bought batteries.
Yeah.
To put in, and then came back to my house, put them in the detector. And I said, you really didn't have to do that. And
I mean, but also.
She did. Also, there were live animals in my house. And I was like, eh.
I would have also done that. I would have been like, no, your smoke detector needs to work.
It sure does. Well, I mean, in fairness, it was only one and we have like 45. So I think somewhere it would have picked up.
Yeah.
But... that was my mentality. But also they are cats. And if anyone was to start a fire in a house, it definitely wouldn't be humans or the dog. It would most certainly be a cat. Yeah. Not that we left anything ablaze, but I'm sure they'd find a way. Where there's a will, where there's a Beethoven, there's a way to start a fire.
I was going to say, Beethoven probably has the ability to start a fire.
Did I tell you? So my friend comes to visit every time that I go out of town. We have this sort of exchange, which is great to have that when you have that. Mm-hmm. I come home from being gone. She hasn't come the last day because I'm showing up. And Beethoven is behind the dryer. Stuck. Just stuck back there. And he's, you know what? He's not even crying.
He's just like, my life now.
This is how I live my life now. And he can't hear. So like, it does us no good to call him.
No.
So I'm sitting here like, looking at Salem, like, he's like Lassie. I'm like,
find your brother.
Where's your brother? Because we just didn't find him for a while. I was like, oh, okay, one, two, wait a minute. Where's the big fluffy one? And so I was like,
who's usually the one that's out? Like,
he's front and center. And I was like, Salem, find your brother. Go find Timmy. Go find Timmy in the well. And Salem just like walked off. Like, life is better now that there's one less of us. And I just was like, oh my God. So eventually we just look and we find, because my fear and the fear of anyone who owns a cat is that they'll get in the dryer, like in the dryer. That's like nightmare fuel.
Yeah.
And so, so I looked in the dryer and I was like, oh God, no. And then like, there's no logic why that would be a thing, but you do. And then, I looked behind and he just looked up at me and was like, oh, hey.
Oh, you found me.
And I just was like, how long have you been down there?
That's funny. My dog Lizzie was not good at alerting you if she was stuck places, and she would occasionally get like locked into a bedroom or something. And so there, and she was also a runner. Like if she got out the front door, she was going to take off. So like I was actively anxious about her escaping. And it probably happened 3 or 4 times in one of the houses I lived in. I had roommates and she would get locked in their bedroom and I'd be like calling her and like running around the house, and she'd just sit right next to the door, quiet as a mouse, just like, someday she'll find me.
One day she'll find me. Well, like, and that's the thing. Basically,
I'm like crying, and I finally open the door, and I'm like,
I was getting there because I was just like,
yeah,
this cat's not in this house anymore. Like, I thought the door had been left open, no one's fault, because he is also a runner. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, so he's gone. Honestly, if you had told me he had like Shawshank Redemption and just like tunneled a hole through the ground,
yeah,
it wouldn't be out with thoughts that I have about that cat. Just put up a poster of like a Ratatouille or something, and just like to cover the hole. Like that's within the realm.
Yeah.
So I just was like, well, I guess. And the problem, though, with that, with him being a runner, is that he is a giant white cat.
Yeah.
That can't hear.
That's
so he's got a max life expectancy out there of 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's like 30 minutes tops.
Right. I mean, yeah. It's not
a good situation for him.
It's not a good situation for him. So I was like, oh my God, oh my God. But anyway, he was fine. He was behind the dryer.
Yeah.
I have to get a drink and then also my glasses.
yeah.
Oh, Christy, this is what you can do. You're not going to, but you should tell everyone about your new tattoo.
Oh, yeah. I can do that. It's cool.
It's really cool.
It is. It's very cute. Well, hey, firstly, welcome to Theology on the Rocks.
Theology on the Rocks! we have music now!
Leah came in. We have music again. Thank you, Mike. We're so excited. And, like, it's just, everything's getting fancy over here, including me. It was Friday the 13th, so I got, it's Woodstock from Peanuts, the little bird, and he's holding a heart balloon. and it's in the itchy phase and it's killing me and I just want to scratch it all of the time. So, but it's very cute anyway. And it's also very dark in comparison to my other tattoos. Now I'm just rambling about this tattoo to nobody, except for to you all, because as we've previously discussed, Leah and I live in the delusion that no one listens to this podcast, but that is not true. So welcome. Oh my God, she's been gone for so long.
I'm not. I just heard as you were flailing there at the end.
I
can hear
it. I ran out of things to talk about with my tattoo. It's itchy though at the moment. So
how much, what is the count now for your Friday the 13th tattoos?
For the Friday the 13th specifically,
or maybe just tiny tattoos.
Woodstock. The paper plane was the first one. There's a paper boat. There's a maca pot. The coffee pot. Yeah, the coffee pot that you do on the stove. There's five. So I have five the Friday the 13th tattoos. Yeah.
Do you have any theme with them, or is it just whatever your fancy is that day?
Yeah, well, because you have to pick from their flash sheets. So,
yeah,
like, you can't be super picky about it, you know?
No.
The first two coordinate, because the first one was a paper plane, and then the second one was a paper boat. So there was a theme that was happening there. But then I ran out of paper objects that were on Friday the 13th flash sheets.
How dare.
And so the third one was the maca pot. And that was a struggle. I was like standing there at that flash sheet, like, I have no idea what to put on my body. And then I saw this and I was like,
okay. But I love at no point you were like, I won't.
Leave? No, that was never an option.
No, that's not an option. We'll find something. I know what mine would be. I would just be like doing spooky things, because there always tends to be spooky things.
There was a spooky thing. And I think that was the one time I almost got a little spooky, like ghost or something.
Yeah.
Which someday I probably will do that. But so I saw and I was like, I like coffee. That goes on my foot. And then the ballet slippers I saw, because I did ballet all through college, and I was like, oh my gosh, that actually is relevant to who I am as a person. It's the only one that I wish that I had gotten not as a Friday the 13th tattoo. Like, I wish I had had that realization to do that and gotten it like customized or bigger or something, you know, like, I like it a lot. I just want it to be more.
Yeah.
So, and then, yeah, this one, cause it was Friday the 13th, but it was the day before Valentine's Day. So they were all like love themed.
She says,
and then I was like, ooh, Woodstock. So
I do like Woodstock.
Yeah.
That was a good call.
Yeah. So anyway, but the heart, cause he filled the heart in, which is probably the right call, but it also means that it's currently really itchy. So just a big black heart on my arm.
What would that guy say that was so keen to center that tattoo? Yeah. The Italian guy that was like, I will center this tattoo.
Well, you know what? Because I got the Orion tattoo first, and then the Italian guy centered the Florence tattoo. And then I got the ballet slippers, and that guy was like, okay, we're going to like tuck this in here so it goes. And then this one, he was like, well, because Orion's in the sky and a balloon goes up. And so I want to put him like right here. He was very intentional about where he put it, this tattoo.
It kind of looks like he's looking up at the sky. I like
it. Yeah. So, you know, they've all been kind of arranged appropriately. But yeah.
That's cool.
Anyway, what did you get to drink?
I have two options. Oh. This is what took me, quote unquote, so long. Mm-hmm. Is I had to pick two things out of the refrigerator. You heard about something called a claw tail.
Oh.
That he hates. he was drinking some seltzers, and then he was like, that's real terrible.
That's fine.
And then I have one of my White Claw Surge left.
Oh, okay.
Now, I've not tried these claw tails. I also feel like I say tails real. My accent really comes
super southern accent.
Yep. The vowels we struggle with.
Tails. It's that you're saying claw first because it's coming out
claw
like
tails.
Claw.
I said something about there are words. One time my friend Susie and I, we came up with a series of like five that are really tough. One of them is skull. And then the phrase jail sale. Jail cell. I almost can't do it. Jail cell. It's really just about the vowel combos. Anyway, claw tails. So I'm thinking I should probably try this. And then
that's what you have to drink first, or at least try it.
Strawberry Cosmos. Okay. Okay.
Okay. I'm excited.
All right. Well, give her a go.
How's it? Cheers.
Mm. Oh.
Do you agree with Stuart?
She looks maybe. Nice. I see what's the problem here. there are multitudes here. I've been watching a lot of like people like eating foods from like Trader Joe's and stuff and doing like reviews of them, and so I feel like this is our version of this. Very professional. The issue is that it's trying to an issue with a lot of seltzers is they're seltzers, right? So they're using like this fake like juice, really. Yeah. Some of them maybe don't, but this one says made with strawberry and cranberry juice. How much of it is truly the question? They don't give percentages.
Is it not enough?
Right. There's something in it that's trying to be like the cocktail, like some sort of simple syrup or something cocktail-y.
Okay.
But the issue is that it's a seltzer.
Yeah.
So it's...
Is it just really sweet? That's my issue with these Truly Unruly's. The Truly Unruly lemonades are just so sweet. I feel like I wouldn't be upset about it, except for that it just feels like I'm drinking like straight syrup.
This was... The makers of White Claw done it again! In lots of exclamation. A lightly sparkling, entirely refreshing twist on the classics.
Oh, so I understand. So it's a claw tail.
It's not a seltzer, Christy, and it's not a cocktail.
It's a claw tail.
It's a claw tail in all caps.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
I mean, I'm still drinking it. So.
I mean,
it feels like there needs to be a pool involved.
Yeah, that's the problem right now. That these Truly Unruly's are really
general.
Inappropriate for the season. We need to be at the beach or at a pool. I need to be eating a burger.
It's true. Yeah. There was a review of your veggie burgers, but it was kind of dire. They just kept saying things tasted like cardboard, and it made me depressed. I like a good cardboard. I like a good veggie burger, but they were just like trash. I was like, oh God, okay. It's like three chucks. Anyway, so announcements that we have here on Theology on the Rocks is. Of course, we're now on our Anazal network, which is fun. Mm-hmm. We're going to interview some of our pals. We actually have a special guest coming on next week.
We do. We're just filled with exciting guests lately.
We now have intro music. What's next? Are we going to jump out of a plane? The answer is no. Are we going to find another wordplay on the phrase White Claw to drink? Yes. Or truly, probably. Mm-hmm. Truly, cruelly. it's like a bunch of gross stuff.
It's just like terrible. We're going to aim for good drinks next week.
Maybe. No, actually, he'll probably. Oh.
Well, our guest will get to pick the drinks.
So. Our guest will get to pick the drink. I have a feeling I know what this guest will pick. I like that it was like a he, but it's like, is that not our my
in the I was gonna say,
it doesn't really limit it.
Nothing.
Right. Pick one.
One of the thousands.
You may or may not have a beard. So we have that, and then last night we did our book group, which was super fun. We read The Bluest Eye, which maybe is our pinnacle of sad book, maybe?
Yeah, it was for sure, I think, our saddest of books. Yeah. It was just sad.
There was no getting away from that.
No. And that is the review that we have for The Bluest Eye.
The Bluest Eye. Our review is shit.
We are depressed now.
And we're sorry, and we're depressed.
We're upset.
And if it makes you feel good, Christine or I have blue eyes.
Yep. So. We also don't have blue eyes.
We also don't have blue eyes. Although we are very white. And again, reply sorry. So we had that. And if you'd like to join our book club, it's become now something that I look forward to, as opposed to I'm always shocked that the book's coming up.
Yeah.
But it is kind of.
I've found that I'm like, ooh, we have book club. We get to do this again. Which is a good thing, you know?
I think I get it.
You and Spirit agree.
We picked the next
three books. So we're super planned out and organized. So in March, we're doing Looking for Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Which John. Is somehow a banned book.
We're not entirely.
I've not read it, but it's ones we haven't read. So I don't know.
And then in April, we're doing one. It's a long title, and I can't
remember. A long title.
It's something about a part-time Indian. That's the whole that I remember.
Yep.
It's
like life of a sort of memoirs or life of a part-time. Right. And then we're doing something about chocolate. That's all.
Yeah, the word chocolate was in it.
So I'm organized.
Oh, wait, yeah. I took a picture of it so that we wouldn't forget what we're doing. Hold up.
Oh, we're on top.
The Chocolate War.
And the common theme was they're on the America's most, Library Association most banned books, I think.
Yeah.
And then we also hadn't read them in our group, and so we thought that would be fun. Fun, she says, but, in quotation marks.
You know what? I think Looking for Alaska might be happy. I feel like it's not going to be depressing. Which would be a shocker for us.
I don't know if we could even meet. We'd just be like, well, we have nothing to say about this.
Get together and just be weepy.
That's how this one started. We got together and we were just like, well.
We're upset now.
Nothing good happened in that book.
Yeah. No, it was rough.
Who are we supposed to like again? That was one of our questions. What is our favorite? So we have that, and so we're getting together in a couple weeks time. Mm-hmm. We're going to AR Southeast
a week
in Greenville. Nope. I'm disassociating from that.
Multiple papers to write.
I have a lot of stuff to do. I am president-elect of that, which I've mentioned before, but I say it not as a flex, but as a, I never want to organize another conference again. I was in a GTA for a really long time, and I did much organizing of conferences because my bosses were really conference heavy. Heather. loved a good conference.
Yeah, she does. She does. Good conference, yeah.
And so I did that for a while. And I just realized you've got to be 20-something to do that.
I was the admin assistant for a department for 6 years and similarly had a lot of organizing of things to do. And I have to tell you that not having that be part of my job is one of the greatest joys of my life. Event organizers are saints among us.
It's true. We are. I mean, the problem too is that I think teachers, we get onto our students for being like not reading the syllabus, but then you realize like teachers also don't read the syllabus. And we're our own worst enemies that way. And also, I'm not getting paid.
Yeah, right.
Am I on the schedule? Did you look on the schedule? Oh,
yeah.
There's a schedule. You just asked me if you were on the schedule. But you don't know if one exists. Oh, yeah. I had that quite. Anyway, it feels like you're on crazy pills sometimes, but I am one of them, and I've done things very similarly. But I will say, like it not getting paid to do it as well as a whole other, like it not being a part of the job that pays you is, because I'll just be like grading and then something will come up for grading for the job I do get paid for.
Right, your actual job. Prepping.
And then it'll be like, oh, like you have this whole list of to-do things. And I'm like, this is a true test of not getting paid labor that we do as academics, which is a big thing. Like if you're thinking about getting into academics, know that there's a lot of unpaid labor.
Yeah, you're going to get overwhelmed with how much you're not getting paid for. My mom asks me almost every time I have something to do, she goes, are you getting paid for that? And 99% of the time I'm like, no. I get it, because I know that that's normal for her to be like, why are you doing this thing if you're not getting paid for it? No, you don't need to bark at him. No, I have a new neighbor, so she's very upset about it.
No.
But yeah, it's like, oh, are you going to get paid for that? No. Are you going to get paid for that? No.
But Christy, I was like, Christy, can you come to Greenville and like hang out with me? But also, these are things we're supposed to be doing as academics, which is like giving papers and like it's stuff we can put on our CV and all that. And connecting and networking, which is a big part. And she's like, yeah. And then it's like, so she has to pay for a flight to get up here. Then I have to pay for a hotel and then pay to drive out there and drive back. And, you know,
registration.
And like, no one, like some of the higher institutions, like when I was at Edinburgh, they would pay for stuff. But even then it was limited.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I had my institution and I am very grateful for this. They paid for big AAR. In Boston, and that was great. And
well, ours was capped even at Edinburgh at like I think a grand or something. Which, if you know to get flights, I mean, again, I was going over the ocean, so but even putting that aside, the hotels in Boston, and I was this is pre Christy, pre her being born.
Yeah, I was not yet
I wasn't there. And so it was like one of one. Yeah, she was.
I was actually at these. We didn't know each other.
And it's like $400 a night for, you know, you've already done, not to mention, you know, like staying alive and, you know, doing all the rest of that stuff. So it's nice, but it's definitely like a Band-aid on a bullet hole, basically. So anyway, unpaid labor, welcome to the glamorous world of academia. And what do I get for being president, you ask? That's a great question. Next year, well, I get to pay to go to Richmond, Virginia. I get to buy a hotel there. I get to give a paper and organize stuff again, and then I'm not president after that year, so that's what I get to do, which is super super fantastic. But you know, it's all a part of the game. A lot of people say like things are games, like in terms of like, you know, like I remember watching The Wolf of Wall Street with my dad, which, by the way, 0 out of 10 recommend.
Watch that with your dad. No. Yeah.
Well, no. And it was about the time that there was cocaine in someone's butt. And I was like, I want to sink into this chair and die. Also, that movie is 500 hours long. It never ends.
A million hours long. Yeah.
A million hours. They keep talking in the movie about essentially Wall Street being like a game. And afterwards, I remember talking to my dad, and he's like, I don't really like get it necessarily. And I was like, I actually do.
Yeah.
Kind of get it. Like, it's a different game. It's a far less lucrative game. But I do think, like, whether it's networking or knowing the right people or meeting people who will one day in 3 years' time have an opening for a job, and, like, you have to put in, you can't just blindly do a lot of, like, apply to jobs and things like
that. Or also, like, I mean, we are supposed to be experts in our content field. And at some stage, if it's been multiple years since I've, like, learned anything, I'm probably not really.
Right.
You know, so, like.
Yeah. Like, doctors and stuff will go to these sort of things.
Yeah. Like there's just an enormous amount of benefit to it for your, this world.
Yep.
But it is also just like, oh my goodness.
Although it is going to make me transcribe these interviews. So there's that. I have some interviews to transcribe.
That's fun.
Nope.
Well.
It's so long. It's,
on that note.
On that note. So guys, we're doing a series and we're going to do this periodically.
Yeah, it's like a sporadic series.
Sporadic series of basically what I like to call our superlatives of theologians.
Yeah.
And so what I have done here is I've brought out, which I will put up on our website, our this is my 2000 yearbook. And I thought, because Christy and I talked about, oh, let's talk about some of our favorite theologians and why we like them and stuff like that. And I thought, what if I picked a superlative just blindly, so I don't know either. And then we just say who would fit into this superlative.
I love this so much. This is like the best game.
Don't forget me when you go to college, Leah. That's my best friend, who, by the way, is still one of my best friends today.
I was like, did you forget me?
She just says, you know where I'll be. So ominous. I got most dependable in this 2000 superlative, which means
you are dependable.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I was in AP English, and they thought that I was the only one who could maybe win, so they voted for me. And I said, don't vote for anything that's like bus dress, because God knows. Okay, so I'm going to do my hand.
Okay. Do, do, do. Oh, we can play another song.
Okay, this one. Oh! This is truly the one, and I didn't know it. Most school spirit as they kiss a tiger.
Ooh.
Who has the most school spirit? Who really loved where they went to school and like brought it up all the time? Or like where they taught? Oh, I think I have one.
You go first. I'm still thinking about this.
Okay. I will say one of my favorite theologians, but one who loved to talk about where they went for good reason, I will say, is James Cone.
Yeah.
Loved to talk about union. Like, and I will say, school spirit is not always just like, oh, I'm like bragging, or oh, this is the thing. Like, part of the thing about James Cone going to union is that there wasn't a lot of, and I should say James Cone is seen maybe as the father of Black theology, or at least someone who's a major contributor.
I think, yeah, typically credited for that. Yeah.
Yeah. But he really, really loved union because there wasn't a lot of places that were open to that kind of thing. And so what we see as well, interestingly, I'm teaching this, which is kind of why it's on my brain, in a class that I'm doing for Mercer, is he also encouraged a lot of women there. And that's where a lot of the womanist theologians came out of, as well as union. So his school spirit was pretty like justified, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because you know, and Union being in New York, it should be noted, like, which I do think is important. So I appreciate that. Like, there's a lot of places that had a lot of theologians that were sort of doing cutting edge stuff, but who were really uncomfortable with it. I'm thinking like Mark Ellis doing a Jewish liberation theology at Baylor and them just like forcing him into retirement, and then Mary Daly, them trying to get rid of, I think she was at maybe Boston College or Boston University, and they tried to get her out, oust her as well. And so the fact that with James Cone, they kind of welcomed him there and actually welcomed what would become the legacy of Union, I would argue, is with that, I think is really important.
I think that that leads into who I would pick as well.
Yeah.
Which is Katie Cannon, also at Union.
I was going to say, did she go to Union? Did she study under James Cone?
No, but she taught at Union.
Ah.
A lot of her work was very specifically focused on her teaching and her pedagogy. And like, if you read through like Katie's canon as a kind of collection of her teachings, she really is like intentional about saying like, this is what I do with my classes, or this is how we teach this thing, or you know, whatever. And so like a lot of focus on teaching, on her experience at Union and those kinds of things. But yeah, very kind of interesting, because like both Union doing this like lifting other people up kind of theology, which is the best kind of school spirit, really.
That is a truly a great school spirit, because like you can throw around your Harvards and your Princetons, but what's happening, you know, and what are they actually like cultivating?
What are you benefiting if
right, and cultivating with faculty as well as students, which I think is important, because you see a lot of, I mean, I think did Kelly Brown Douglas go to Union as well?
I believe that she did.
There's quite a few of these womanist and Black theologians that just like went there and just thrived. I'm thinking Copeland as well, but yeah, great school spirit. I mean, if you gotta be.
Kelly Brown Douglas also went to Union.
There you go.
Her advisor was James Cone.
I mean, and you see, like, when I was teaching at Edinburgh, I bring it up because it's one of those schools where there's a lot of people that want to have this legacy. And I remember it got brought up a lot. Like, what's your legacy? And I'm like, my legacy is going to be surviving a school like this, I think, with my integrity intact. And it's not saying anything bad about the school necessarily. It's just when you're in a really competitive school like that, in terms of students and faculty, is that people have a real desire to have like their own ideas carry on, basically.
And I think too, there's a cultural conversation, which obviously I think, especially with Cone and Cannon, one of the key features is that they're both intentionally doing liberation theology.
Yeah.
And you can't do liberation theology without the desire to lift other people up. Like, if you're doing liberation theology just so you can get famous, you're probably bad at it. So there's a kind of inherent partnering of what they're doing and how they're going to behave. And then I would assume cultivating a similar kind of culture at Union as well.
Yeah, like, and getting students to come there. That
like Kelly Brown Douglas also has this kind of belief, is also very concerned with lifting people up and supporting her students and stuff like that. So, like, obviously that's part of it. But, like, when you go to places that don't have that, are doing more individual theology.
And I think that's right. I think that's the difference, is you know, and what I will say that is a positive, just so I can balance it out, is that I was lucky enough to fall into the group of people who are doing practical theology, especially related to sexuality, a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, Cecilia and Marcel and all that group, like, I was lucky to fall into that because that was that could not have existed. In which case I would have just been fighting for someone to supervise me on another dissertation about Karl Barth or John Calvin, probably. he stood in our courtyard. I was lucky in that sense, but those kind of people, and they instilled in me that same thing that I know you got instilled as well, is this idea of, you know, your legacy is more about encouraging people to study these topics and to be interested in these topics, which is what we both do very well, mm-hmm. as opposed to just have people forever repeating your ideas. I mean, don't get me wrong. When someone quotes Bad Theology, which our special guest next week, this is, has used it very recently in an article, like, that is incredibly...
It's an honor, and it's inspiring, and it's really, like...
It is, but you can't let ego be the reason that you do academics, because I think that is a downfall. It ceases the sort of innovative creativity and curiosity that I think makes it so appealing to people like you and I. And yeah. So it's a real ego battle in that sense of, like...
For sure, it is. Yeah.
Like, if Chrissy and I don't get invited to something, or, you know, we should have been there. We could have talked about that. But then also balancing with that person can also talk about it. Like,
yeah.
There are probably reasons, and or we didn't get this X, Y, and Z job or something. Academics is a real battle with that. I always think, like, narcissists should never be academics. I know a lot of them that are, though.
I was going to say, it's a field filled with them.
But because people are just listening to you talk.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to be said about, like, an incredible amount of hubris. I mean, this is true of anybody who goes into, like, acting or performing. Mm. Like, you...
Ministry, I would say, too.
There's a whole bunch of fields that you're going into that you have to have some amount of, like, either comfort or excitement that people are going to be staring at you for, you know, a solid bit, and that you're
going to... And we did talk about this with Josh Knoll.
Right. Well, and, like, that
statement, I just want people to listen to my music choice and to not talk. So you basically want to lecture on your music choice.
I don't. Yeah. But, like,
no, I do too. I'm not.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a,
I think it's funny.
I think it's funny. And I think it's something, you know, you and I are both this way as well. Like, we don't mind being up on stage talking and stuff. Like, we're not, we're not ever going to
turn chairs that. Throwing chairs at other academics.
You know, somebody's like, hey, you want to get on stage and do this? Probably I'm going to say yes. But also, I think this is what I think is the key bit, is, like, is the goal to be on stage?
Mm-hmm.
Or is the goal, like, I think I have a thing to say or something that can help people.
Right.
And those are where you're going to find the kind of diverging attitudes with a lot of people, you know, like, am I just trying to be on stage, or am I like, yeah, like, I can help with this thing. Oh, you need somebody to talk about that? I can talk about that. That's great. You know, like, or, you know, I want to lend advice or thoughts or whatever to a conversation, but, like, yeah. And that said, also, I fall into the place of being like, no, I just want to be on stage. Like,
I mean, but I think there's a thing. Like, I did ministry and I was a theater major, and now I'm an academic. And I think that the thing is, you have to have a little bit of that, because if you don't want to talk to people, or you can't fill in the silence, or you can't make something a teachable moment, then, you know, then that's maybe not the career for you in terms of higher ed. Like, and I'm not sure after this episode if people are going to want to do higher ed or not.
We are.
I don't know what we have presented here. Okay. So most school spirit, I'm so Jim Cohn and Katie Cannon, Katie Geneva.
Katie.
All I get, Jim gets a James gets a Jim, and Katie gets her full name.
Katie Geneva Cannon and Jim Cohn. And Jim Cohn.
Somebody said Jim Cohn once to me, and I'm sure it's someone who was like a friend of James Cohn. Like, it clearly wasn't me.
If somebody said Jim Cohn to me, I would immediately say, who are you talking about? Because Jim is not, that is wrong. Like,
someone said, this is a problem, because if you automatically say something like nicknameish, then so someone who you know said Kathy Tanner once.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they are friends.
Yeah.
And now, but she would repeat it. Mm-hmm. So now when if I was to ever meet Catherine Tanner, who by the way knows me from no one.
No.
And I rock up and I'm like, hey, Kathy, how's it going?
It would be hilarious.
She will probably be nice about it, honestly, but I wouldn't be.
I remember the first time I heard somebody refer to NT Wright as mom.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm so sorry, what?
I think that's more common, though. I've heard him called Tom Wright, but that may just be the Scottish connection. Because wasn't he at St. Andrews?
Connection. Yeah, he was at St. Andrews. It's the Scottish connection, because
yeah.
it was in Scotland that I first heard somebody say Tom. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, that's not right.
That's not right. Oh, I've seen him once at Edinburgh. And it was interesting. Speaking of legacy.
I have so many stories about that man, but they are for in-person.
That's why beer guys sign up for beer camp.
You can hear the gossip. Me and I will spill all the tea.
That we have just enough connection. We're just famous enough.
Yep.
That we're actually just famous and not famous enough to where we're like in that middle thing of like having the tea. But the team not really having any consequences, because
like it won't matter at all that we're in the room when stuff happens.
No,
we're in the room when stuff happens.
Right. We're Lady Whistledown.
Yeah.
If you have seen Bridgerton, shall I pick another one, or are we doing one?
Well, I had a question for you about James Cohn.
Ask me. I'm ready.
Maybe like a couple of questions, actually, because I want to kind of like sit with these two people for a second.
Let's do it. Also know that in the year 2000, All-Star by Smash Mouth was the top song voted by students. And that's why we shouldn't be trusted with anything.
Yes. When was the first time that you encountered Jim Cohn's work?
Jim Cohn. I feel it also makes him sound a little bit like I don't know, like a redneck. Of
something. It really removes some of the seriousness.
Really, it truly does. I probably, in all honesty, read The Womanist Theologians and then came to him as a secondary, which is really interesting, I think.
That is really interesting, yeah.
You would think it's the other way around. But I think I read Phyllis Trible and she was the first one that I read the Text of Terror stuff. And then I read Kate Cannon stuff. And I think I came to Dolores Williams. I came to him as a result of them, which is, I don't know that would be his favorite thing, but that is what happened.
That's what happened. And you know what? That's probably not a bad thing.
No, not at all. I mean, I came through a lot of feminist theologians via queer theology. So, but a lot of this is who you encounter. And so who people are telling you.
Which is why I think it's interesting to like ask like when and where.
Yeah.
When you first.
Yeah. I would say certainly Edinburgh, I think that's where I read him. I don't think, I was a student there as well, I should say.
Yeah.
And when I was a PhD student, because I don't think we read. I was at Mercer though. I'm sure we had chats about him at Mercer in theology, but it didn't latch on in the same way that I think when I went, which is weird because it was Atlanta, you would have thought, but when I went to Scotland, it did in a different, because I had more context for it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, when you learn theology in seminary, it oftentimes is like rapid fire. Like these are all the people.
Yeah.
And I think when I was able to just sit with some of the liberation folk, that interested me, that it made more sense.
Well, this is kind of, again, this is part of my inspiration of the question, though, because I remember learning about James Cone in seminary, and it was that rapid fire. It was my contemporary theology course. Yeah. And I remember just kind of being like, it kind of startled me. I don't know what other word to use, but like it was
jarring. It was jarring.
It was jarring. And I was just like, sitting in the dark. There we go. I turned a light on. It's better. Yeah.
I was worried that you were getting depressed as we talked.
It was sinking into the bluest eye again.
Right. She was just going to start singing like Fall Out Boy in a minute.
But yeah, it was jarring. And I didn't know how to file it. I didn't have a file cabinet at that moment.
Yeah, same. And you're just like, you're like a sponge that's just taking in it all.
Yeah, there's too much. And then... And so I knew, and I had read some of his stuff, and I was like, I don't know where to put this. So I just kind of, it just kind of sat like on a table in my mind.
Somewhere. You know? Yeah.
And then when I went to Glasgow and I was reading Katie Cannon, I was like, okay, I'm going to go back now because I have better context. And then I was much more prepared and capable of like hearing what he was saying, but also like having the like time and space to sit with it and not be that rapid fire was really helpful for me.
So it's basically the same. We have the same story, but I mean, it's right. And you can sometimes when you can like put people into historical context as well, it helps. And so like, while I knew where he sat, I didn't get the sort of totality of it all. And I think that was helpful for me. To understand, I know the first one I read was, what is it? The Cross and the Lynching Tree
Yeah. That's what I read in seminary too. And it was just like,
And I needed to read, I think reading Marcella was helpful because then I couldn't be shocked anymore.
Yeah. That is accurate.
For me, as a woman who grew up in sort of purity culture, once I read her stuff, I was like, well, okay, so, and I think I needed to do that, because then I read James Cone's stuff, and I was like, oh, like, this makes complete sense to me now.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know,
tracking it.
Right. All of this is tracking, and then I was like, y'all, maybe, I wonder if they did.
This is kind of a weird callback, and I realize that our book club doesn't get put on the podcast, but feels very similar to my, like, how we talked about The Bluest Eye last night. Of like, there was nowhere to put it.
Yeah.
It's just, like, sitting on a table in my brain as being this, like, difficult thing to process.
The book group conversation was so good, and I left, and I felt good about it, and then I was like, oh my god, were we just, like, a bunch of white people talking about Toni Morrison? And then I thought, well, we were. But actually, I think we were quite honest about that. And I think that's how I felt reading James Cone.
Yeah.
Is like, I think you just have to, there's a difference between being open, but also knowing that like, you may not be able to understand an experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like.
And you have to have the ability to say, because what I think is really important when we're reading literature or theology or anything is to be able to say, I can't understand this experience in a way that like I could relate to, but that doesn't mean I can't either empathize or recognize that it's teaching me something new or allow for it to be a true thing or whatever. Like, I don't have to be like, oh yes, I understand or I relate to this thing to be able to absorb it, you know?
Totally. And I think some things need to sit on a shelf for a while.
Some things need to sit there and, like, you know, be just kind of, I hate using this term, but like marinating.
Yeah.
You know, like it just needs to sit for a minute.
And like, you need to have maybe life experiences and learn more and then, or, you know,
or like, yeah, like
experience life. And it's like,
build a file cabinet for it.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, that thing that was a rapid fire thing locks into place and you're like, oh, like now I'm teaching. It's funny because I've come full circle. I'm teaching that contemporary theology course. I'm teaching this to students who were me when I got taught it in a rapid fire way and it was marinating, and I'm like, well, maybe it'll marinate for them as well.
Yeah.
And that's a real interesting thing, because when I present him now in the class, you know, I'm like, this may seem not your cup of tea.
Yep.
You know, and that's for any of the theologians we look at. But I'm like, you know, just hold it back there. And yeah. One day it might make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
that's the thing that I so appreciate, is that I learned about James Cone in seminary. Like, I was exposed to him and to others that I didn't have a file cabinet for yet.
Mm.
But when I did, when I came back to him in my PhD, I remember having this moment. Like, I remember kind of distinctly of sitting there, and I was reading through his dissertation on, he studied Bart, and he did Bart stuff.
You told me this is part of our wine debate.
But he,
quote unquote,
the conversation, like the way he was explaining stuff, the way he was interacting with it and everything, because I had already let myself marinate, which is kind of a weird process, like, but I had already marinated on The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And so then I was reading this stuff on Bart, and I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I understand. Like, I am following you. And I think that this teaching is important and necessary and everything, you know, like, and it was such a better experience. And now I have such a like big appreciation for him, you know, but it took me some time experiencing stuff to get there. So,
yeah. And honestly, it took me reading some of the womanist criticism of James Cone and Black theology as being very male centered. To actually want to read, to see what was being said. And, you know, I really appreciate it. I want to ask the same question to you though, with Katie Cannon. You did say you read her, but what was the first thing that you read of her stuff?
Yeah. The first thing I read of hers was an essay on Zora Neale Hurston. Cause she did a lot of work in terms of like, how can we read Hurston and talk about theology. And so I read that, and I thought that it was, I was already kind of in a place where I was ready for that. And also I was familiar with Hurston's work. And so that really helped, because I knew what she was talking about, you know? And then I was able to read Katie's Canon, which is it's a collection of essays. Most of them geared towards students, which is a great way to introduce yourself to Katie Cannon, because they are at the right level for that first like big experience, you know, like she's in teaching mode when she's going through those.
Yeah.
So that was really helpful. That said, there are several chapters on chattel slavery. So it was also very depressing. And very difficult to kind of work through. It was geared towards people who were new to the conversation. So that was helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're like,
I mean, in a lot of, I taught this week on feminist theology, and we talked about some of the issues that, especially like, I was talking about Maria Sassi Diaz, and about Mujerista theology, and about some of her issues with the Marian theology.
Yeah.
And I have a few Catholic students in my class, and it was really interesting, because I was just like, I mean, she's talking about Mary. You know, everyone thinks I'm being so like brash when I say like Mary got pregnant by God, but I was like, we do kind of just assume that this isn't a crazy story.
Right.
You know.
Like that's kind of built into the whole
Christian. Yeah, we just say it like every year, and then someone will say something else, and like of another religion will be like, that's wild and crazy. And I'm like, well, did God in their religion knock up a young woman who is engaged to someone else? Because that's zero.
Your dog. Penny is like, who is that dog barking right now?
Zero.
Yeah, no.
All these different barks now. So, like, this bark is definitely Amazon. This is an Amazon bark.
Yeah.
Because the bark is not, like, as intense,
yep.
but it lasts for a while. And it's because the Amazon truck is making its way down the road, and he recognizes the truck.
Mm-hmm. Penny is the same way with delivery men, where it's like...
Dad was taking a nap, and I heard his door close. Oh, no.
So Zero is in trouble, Penny. Yeah.
Penny's like, not me. I'm good now. Look, I'm an angel.
Good dog. We'll see a delivery truck and just immediately start barking.
He knows even the colors.
Deliver anything to us. It's just like that truck certainly is going to
go. The Amazon van or the UPS van, and he can see it. And he's like, it's the blue and brown van of Satan.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's I think it's helpful to occasionally look at.
That's what I was saying. The Catholic students. Sorry, I got distracted. Sorry, yeah. I didn't interrupt you. But the Catholic students were just like, but Mary. And I'm like, no, I am not taking away Mary from you. I'm not. Yeah. But also some of the Protestant students were like that too. They were like, but that's an important part of our story. And I'm like, it is. But what the feminist theologians are trying to say is that we're venerating this woman because she was this, you know, virginal person who was, you know, accepted God's will. But we need to remember what God's will was in this instance.
Yeah.
And that was a difficult, because we'd watched Mary Magdalene, which, by the way, if you've not seen that film, I would endorse.
It is
quite good. It's got Joaquin Phoenix and Mara Rooney in it.
I had heard of it. I have not seen it, but
it's theologically interesting. And as the ones that we have watched so far, which include, I've been on an emotional journey with this class. It's good. It's really good. I think it says a lot. Actually. Yeah.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah. So, but my point was that I think we oftentimes need to face some of these things that make us uncomfortable, whether that's Mary, whether that is, you know, the legacy of slavery and or even, you know, queer community and all that they have been through and women in ministry or whatever. I think it's important that even if it doesn't affect us necessarily, to have to kind of look at it.
I agree. I think it's so important for us to realize that, like, it doesn't have to affect us for it to be important and true.
Mm-hmm.
We still need to be able to learn about other people's experiences and everything. But also, like, we need to be able to be confronted by stuff that's really uncomfortable and, like, to grow from that. So,
yeah.
You know,
and to know what stuff, you brought up a really good point in our book group, is about perception and, like, what stuff do we push back against and what stuff do we not necessarily want to get, or what stuff's still marinating on the shelf? Like, there's stuff for me that still sits up there that I have
an issue with
and I can't engage with it, but it doesn't mean that it should be off the shelf necessarily, because it's not bad theology. It's just that it's hard.
Yeah.
I can't necessarily engage with it right now where I'm at.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of stuff that we need to recognize that, like, I might be wrong about this thing and I need to keep being open to that. And, like, you know, obviously, like, you and I have done an immense amount of work to come to theological positions that we believe in at the moment. So I feel pretty secure in most of them.
Yeah.
But I also feel like I need to make sure I'm never stubbornly holding on to things. Yes.
We need to not become the bubble that we are pushing back against.
Yeah. So.
Well, no one got, we didn't pick best stressed, which would have been.
You know what? That's our next time. We have to do superlatives.
We have many more. That was actually really good.
It was perfect. Yeah. Because we're going to, this is going to be like a sporadic series that we do, and I love it so much. I think it's gonna be super fun,
and you get to add to your rapid fire sort of knowledge of theologians. You get to hear from us, and
you get to see how well we do at rapid fire knowledge about theologians.
That one just, that
That was off the cuff. Anyway, we're excited. Wait,
we'll see you next week where we will be joined with
guest
with a man.
By a man. We're letting him.
We'll spray it down. We'll spray down the feed after we get done.
Yeah. We got to, I mean, honestly, after this one, we got to like have a woman back or something because it's been man heavy.
We'll dig around and find one.
We'll search the depths. We'll search the depths and get a woman. All right. Bye, y'all.
Bye.